To start things off today, there's more bad news out of Iraq. A lot being said about the violence there. 74 Americans reported dead already this month. And we're not even through the month of October. If we continue at this current rate, we will lose 120 Americans this month, which will make this the third deadliest month of the war. Keep in mind that when we lost more people in April of 2004 and November of 2004, we had full-scale offensives going on in places like Fallujah and Najaf. Now it's, you know, day-to-day operations nearly as deadly as when we were involved in open warfare 2 years ago. I don't know that there's much distinction for people on the ground in Iraq. But for some perspective on this, I've called upon Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who is the assistant managing editor of the Washington Post. He was the Baghdad bureau chief for the Post and has written about what life is like inside the Green Zone and can give us an inside Baghdad and inside Iraq perspective. His new book is just out. It's called Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Rajiv, welcome to KMOX.
Hey, good to be here with you, Paul, and I just wish this conversation could be as exciting and uplifting as your Cardinals victory last night.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think this is going to be more the Mets' point of view on things, that things just aren't going very well today when we talk about Iraq. Now, we have one of our hosts who was in Iraq earlier this year, John Grayson, and he spent most of his time inside the Green Zone. And it sounded to me, in my discussions with him on a daily basis during that entire week, like Baghdad is two different cities. Is that about right?
It's totally true. I mean, imagine sort of the ultimate gated suburban community right there in the center of a city, and then the most violent slums and other neighborhoods on the outside. And that's sort of what Iraq is. And I don't mean to belittle the Iraqi people who live outside that zone, but when you look at the Green Zone itself, you know, it's a place where you have 24-hour-a-day electricity, and you're lucky to get about 8 or 10 hours outside the walls in the real Iraq. Obviously, it's far more dangerous outside than inside. But in the inside, it really is, it's a little America. It's a tiny little bubble in there where people drive around in brand-new Chevy Suburbans, their bars, their discos, their swimming pools, their gymnasiums. There's Bible study classes and salsa dancing lessons. It is like a little slice of Americana right in the heart of Iraq. And there's, on some levels, there's nothing wrong with bringing some comforts of home for the many, many thousands of brave Americans who are there working either for the military or for the embassy or for other contracting firms trying to reconstruct and stabilize Iraq. But what I write about in this book is really the surreal nature of this place and how I believe in the first year of our presence there, in that very crucial window of opportunity we had as Americans, because, you know, make no mistake about it, the Iraqi people were grateful to be liberated. They wanted to go on with moving toward a democracy. They wanted to rebuild their country. And we had that window of opportunity, and I think the way we set up this Green Zone, and more importantly, the people we sent there and the policies they pursued, really squandered a real important opportunity. And in many ways, those mistakes are as responsible for the mess we find ourselves in today as the failure to send enough troops there immediately after the liberation of Iraq, or the failure to grasp the growth of the insurgency.
One of the things that I found in your book is that politics, rather than experience, played a role in who gets to go over there and be a part of this. And I'm not talking about the soldiers, yep, but I'm talking about the people who wear a suit and tie and help set the policies. You have a story in there about one guy who was sent over there to put Iraq's university system back together, and he had no experience in reconstruction of any kind and had never been to the Middle East.
That's true, and never read a book about that part of the world. But he was friends with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's wife, and he was friends also with Liz Cheney, the wife of the vice president. You know, this is one of the most shocking elements of the book, I think, Paul, that that instead of sending the best and the brightest for this enormous challenge, this very important task at hand for the American people, in many cases, we sent over the loyal and the willing. People who were chosen more because of their loyalty to the Republican Party, to the White House, than because they had skills in the Arabic language, in post-conflict reconstruction, experience in the Middle East. People were asked, and I kid you not here, people were asked in their pre-deployment interviews questions like, what are your views on Roe versus Wade? Did you vote for George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election? Are you a member of the Republican Party? Now, you know, I submit that for or against Roe v. Wade, it doesn't matter. What you want are people who have some experience in rebuilding war-torn countries, people who have some experience out in the Middle East. Those were the questions that should have been asked.
And did the people who gave the, quote, wrong answer to those questions not get to go?
In many cases, yeah. Their resumes were thrown into the trash, and they were told, thank you very much, but we don't have a place for you.
You know, and some listening might say, okay, that's party politics, it's fine, you can ask those questions, but could you still have found someone qualified to do the job?
Well, you know, I think that there were plenty of qualified Republicans and there were plenty of qualified Democrats. And had we just sought qualifications as opposed to
loyalty,
and you know, it started from the very beginning when the decision was made, okay, how do we send people to Baghdad? The job of hiring people was given over to an office in the Pentagon that looks for political appointees as opposed to looking for people with subject matter expertise.
There's a story in the New York Times today, if you don't mind my mentioning a rival newspaper.
No problem.
Major General William B. Caldwell IV, who's one of our top American commanders there, essentially says, we're going to have to change things up here if we're going to win back control of Baghdad, that the sectarian death squads and the insurgents are increasing violence across the city. He says, quote, the violence is disheartening. Our campaign to gain control of the city has not met our overall expectations of sustaining a reduction in the levels of violence. We're working very closely with the government of Iraq to determine how to best refocus our efforts. You speak bureaucratese, Rajiv. Translate that for me.
That's a very blunt admission that the current American strategy is not working. As you and all of your listeners know, you know, we have concentrated our troops in Baghdad in an effort to try to stabilize the capital with the hope that you fix the center and the periphery also starts to become a little bit more stable. And so additional thousands of troops have been deployed in Baghdad neighborhoods to try to get a handle on the insurgency and trying to put a stop to the sectarian fighting. And as we all know so well, and as you mentioned in the lead-in to this segment, this is one of the deadliest months thus far, and it's on track to put us into one of the deadliest months on record in Iraq. And the fighting between Iraqis has not abated. If anything, it's getting worse. Shiite death squads still roam the city with impunity. Sunni insurgent suicide bombers are still conducting bloody attacks day in, day out. And so what we have here is an admission by a senior military official in Baghdad that the current strategy is not working. And we're also hearing out of Washington, I should make a note of a story that's in my own newspaper, The Washington Post, this morning, that very senior Republicans on Capitol Hill and elsewhere are coming to the conclusion that the current policy is just untenable and that there's going to have to be a fairly significant shift in American strategy. And I think what we're going to see after the election, when former Secretary of State James Baker's Iraq Study Group comes out with its recommendations, I think we're going to see some fairly bold initiatives that will add a lot of will add to this national debate here. I mean, you might see, for instance, proposals that we sort of step back from democratization in Iraq and instead try to install a government of national unity that can take a harder line against radicals, both Sunni and Shiite. You might see calls for a timetable for a U.S. withdrawal. I think that there are a lot of things that have previously been sort of seen as off limits to the Republicans that Republican candidates and Republican officials are now starting to be willing to embrace, given that the current strategy just does not seem to be working.
Well, one of the reasons they didn't want to embrace that is because this White House has branded anybody who disagrees with the way they're fighting the war a cut and run candidate or politician or pundit or whatever it is. They keep using that phrase. If you're not with us, if you don't agree with the way we're doing things, then you just want to cut and run. And now we're finding out that more and more generals are saying, hey, we're doing it the wrong way. And some politicians, even from his own party, are saying that. Is that filtering back to the president? Is he starting to say, hey, you know what? Maybe we do have to come up with a different strategy.
Well, not being a fly on the wall in the Oval Office, what I can say from all I'm picking up is that we're not seeing signs that it has yet. But I think that, you know, you can keep saying cut and run when you're directing it toward Democrats, and that is something of a politically workable strategy. But when you have senior members of your own Republican Party coming out and saying the current policy is not tenable, when you've got senior military officers raising questions, then it becomes much tougher to continue to insist, if you're the President of the United States, that you can't readjust the policy. And I think that if former Secretary of State James Baker, who's an eminent statesman, and he's got a bipartisan group in this Iraq study group, if they come out with some compelling proposals, it's going to be very hard for the president just to dismiss that, particularly in light of the facts on the ground. I think that you can sort of say you can brush them off if the metrics look better, if it looks like we're stabilizing Iraq, but when the current strategy is clearly not working, it's really tough to sort of say, I'm not going to listen to other ideas.
I want to talk about these stories coming out of the southern part of Iraq today, particularly in Amara and others around them, which is an area that is controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr, the anti-American cleric, and one of the guys who I think is responsible for a lot of the bad stuff going on in Iraq. These are people whose input is so important inside that country. Has the impact of the religious leaders and the militia leaders in that country been underestimated by the Bush administration?
Oh, totally. And on two levels here. You know, Muqtada Sadr, make no question about it. He is a bad man. He commands a lot of people who are out to do very nefarious things. In fact, many of the extrajudicial killings that are taking place in Baghdad, many of these sectarian killings are the result of his al-Mahdi army militia. But, you know, dealing with him is not a simple, straightforward, just go out and try to arrest him, kill him sort of matter. He's got a movement that really, in some ways, transcends his own cult of personality. And in some ways, it's like Hezbollah in South Lebanon. You know, you can go after them militarily, but it's a bit like whack-a-mole. You hit them in one place, they rise up in another. And ultimately, there has to be sort of a two-pronged approach to go after them, both militarily but also politically, to give a way for his followers, many of whom are young and disaffected and poor, a future future in terms of employment, a sense that they have a role in Iraqi society. And I think that many of them are picking up weapons because they don't see any other option. But there's also been a great underestimation of the power of Shiite religious parties, and that began from the very early days. I remember American officials in Baghdad in the summer of 2003, when Ayatollah al-Sistani, who we all now recognize as a very influential figure, sort of the Pope of Iraq, when he issued some of his first religious edicts, he was sort of blown off by people in the palace who thought, here's just a guy, an old guy with a turban. He's issued a fatwa. We'll just get somebody to issue another one. We really did, from the very beginning, underestimate the influence and power that all of these individuals have.
And what's funny about that is, here in the United States, extremist religious organizations tend to have a lot of power in Washington, D.C., and yet we don't pay attention to extremist religious organizations and their power in Iraq.
There are a lot of these disconnects. You make a great point there. Another one is when we look at some of the reasons for civil war there. I'm not going to blame this entirely on American decisions that were made right after the liberation of the country, but it is instructive to sort of turn back the clock. And I write about a bit of this in the book. In this country, the Bush administration is so opposed to quotas for anything, right? We don't want racial quotas for hiring and sort of stuff. But when it came to trying to build Iraq's governing council and trying to find the members for it, our viceroy there at the time, Ambassador Paul Bremer, used a strict quota system. Said, okay, we're going to have 13 Shiite Arabs, 5 Sunni Arabs, 5 Sunni Kurds. And it was a powerful message to the Iraqi people, who prior to that point, really viewed themselves as Iraqis first, and maybe Sunnis or Shiites secondary. It told them that, hey, from this point forward, you're going to be classified and categorized by your sect. shaped by your ethnicity. And again, I'm going to be clear with your listeners. I'm not trying to suggest that this was the sole cause of the civil strife we face there now, but I think it was a precipitating factor. And so in trying to understand where we are today, it is very important to go back to those early months and decisions that were made. And that's what I try to chronicle in this book.
Rajiv, there have been several people, including Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, who have said, you know what, why don't we just divide Iraq up into three separate countries? The Kurds, who seem to be doing well in their semi-autonomous northern part of the country, and then we'll give another third of the country to the Shiites and another part of the country to the Sunnis, and we'll divide the country up that way, and we can get the heck out of there. Tony Snow said that that's a non-starter of an idea. What do you think of it?
Let me give you three reasons why this could be a profoundly bad idea. First off, moving people from one place to another. Iraq is in many parts of Iraq, you have a lot of mixed communities, and forcing them to relocate will lead to a lot of violence. It could spark the broader civil war that we don't want to see. Remember the partition of India and Pakistan in 1948, just how bloody it was, and the wars it precipitated. You know, we could be creating an even bigger problem by trying to move populations in that country. Number two, what do you do with Baghdad? Baghdad is a thoroughly mixed city. You have neighborhoods. In fact, most neighborhoods in Baghdad are not based on Sunnis or Shiites, but they're based on people with similar professional associations. It sounds strange to say to an American audience, but, you know, you have the doctor's neighborhood, the lawyer's neighborhood, the retired Air Force officer's neighborhood, and they're all mixed religiously, ethnically. You know, how do you break that up? And then if you have a Kurdish region in the north that, by the way, has oil deposits, and a Shiite region in the south and the center that, by the way, has oil money, you have a Sunni region in the middle, Sunnistan, that has no resources. And yes, you could come up with some sort of revenue-sharing agreement, but a real fear is you'd get a dirt-poor Sunni region that will be lawless and would be a breeding ground for international terror.
Rajiv, in the book, you put a lot of blame on Paul Bremer. You say he ignored what Iraqis said they needed. Talk to me about what the problem was with this guy being our top guy in Iraq.
Yeah, good question. You know, I didn't start out thinking he was the wrong man for the job. In fact, I, after my first interview with him, felt incredibly optimistic that he would really take charge of this effort and do what was necessary and, more importantly, listen to the Iraqis and work with them as partners. And what happened, unfortunately, is that Bremer really stopped listening to what the Iraqi people wanted and needed and wound up, you know, cloistered in the green zone with a small circle of advisors and wound up pursuing and promulgating policies that really were out of step with the realities on the ground. And it wasn't just disbanding Iraq's army. It wasn't just the policy that kicked out of work, you know, tens of thousands of mid-level Ba'ath Party members, people who did not have blood on their hands, people who were not cronies of Saddam, people who, by all accounts, should have kept their jobs and been productive members of society. But there were all sorts of other things. I mean, take, for instance, economic policy. You know, got a country there with 40, 50% unemployment. You know, basic common sense tells you you'd show up there and you might, you know, try to promote some job creation programs, some sort of New Deal-like things that would get people, unemployed people, off the streets and back rebuilding looted buildings, you know, cleaning up war damage, you name it. Well, instead, Bremer and his people came in and they had these fanciful notions of what needed to be done for economic development. One of them was, you know, to write a new tax code. And in fact, they wasted a lot of time doing this. And they implemented something that's a dream of neoconservatives in this country. Iraq has a 15% flat tax. It's on the books. I mean, now, nobody pays taxes, nobody enforces this, but we spent a lot of time doing that. We rewrote their laws on intellectual property, on microchip designs, on genetically modified seed varietals. We even gave them a new traffic law. I mean, this sounds ludicrous, but we rewrote line by line their traffic law. We brought in elements of an enlightened traffic law, the state of Maryland's motor vehicle code, and we've written such things as you must put both hands on the steering wheel while driving, no excessive use of the horn, pedestrians walking in dusk should be wearing light and reflective clothing.
And this was in the first year to year and a half of the war.
This was in the first 15 months, that crucial period of time when we should have been devoting all of our resources to getting the lights back on, getting the water flowing, preventing looting, involving the Iraqis, informing an interim government, doing the most basic elements of reconstruction. We were out just thinking about this kind of ideal society that we were going to build. And in many ways, we were sort of thinking so far ahead and with such a degree of micromanagement and failing and to deal with the most important and pressing problems at hand. That's why I say we squandered an enormous opportunity. And so that's really, you know, what I'm trying to bring to light here, because I think this is a story that the American people just haven't really understood as yet.
Because we had a terrific war plan. We just didn't have any kind of decent post-war plan. And it seemed like it was, well, what do we do now? Well, do this. All right, we'll try that. Well,
yeah, it was like sending on, you know, Bremer was like the quarterback who sent on the field without a playbook. He's just meant to call audibles. And I commend him for trying to do his best under these circumstances, but, you know, he failed to sort of, you know, read the game properly. And, you know, an analogy here, Paul, is, you know, if you think of Iraq as a broken down car, you know, what the Iraqi people wanted was some help, you know, changing the spark plugs, pouring some oil on the engine and getting it moving and making the repairs along the way. Bremer's view was, we want to make Iraq the best possible car. And so we're going to put it up on the blocks, we're going to take the engine out, and we're going to rebuild it bolt by bolt. Yes, at the end of the day, you'll get a much better engine, but your passengers don't want to sit around and wait.
Yeah, the chrome will be really shiny, but the car won't drive. there are reports again this week about problems with our training of the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. The idea that we keep hearing from the White House is we want to be able to turn Iraq over to the Iraqis and let them run their own country. But it seems like part of the problem, according to the reports in some published reports this week, is that the people we're sending over there to do the training have no idea what life is like over there. Much the same theme that we talked about earlier. We don't have enough Americans who speak Arabic. We're not giving them enough training in how to deal with Iraqis. Plus, the Iraqis, apparently, are the hardest people in the world to train or are not willing to learn. I don't know what the truth is there. Do you?
Well, I think the latter part of that is a real blame the victim thing, right? When you can't make anything else work, you just blame the people who you're supposed to be helping. You know, I've worked with an awful lot of Iraqis in the 2 years I've been there, and I think if you approach them with respect, if you approach them with skill, they will be very receptive. I've trained a lot of Iraqis to be, I think, really good journalists operating in a free society. It's possible. It's doable. It all depends on your mindset. But, you know, this is yet again with the training of the security forces, bungling something that we've been bungling now for 3 years. I mean, let's go back to before the war. There were confidential, classified assessments presented to the National Security Council that said we need 5,000 police trainers to go to Iraq. Those were dismissed out of hand. Right after the liberation of Iraq, the Justice Department sent in an assessment team to figure out what Iraq's police forces needed to be rebuilt. They quickly came up with a figure of 6,600 foreign police advisors needed to go and train and re-equip the Iraqi cops. How did the White House respond? They sent one guy, a guy named Bernie Kerik, the former New York City police commissioner during 9/11. He was a national hero, well-respected, but when he showed up there, he was all about giving interviews to the media, doing some very showy raids for the TV cameras, and he spent very, very little time actually training the Iraqi police. And I detail this in the book, and it was, again, you know, that was a crucial window of opportunity. We missed it, but it seems like we still haven't gotten our act together in this. And we all know that getting the Iraqi security forces to be sustainable, to stand up on their own 2 feet, is a key prerequisite to getting out of there.
Yep, and we've been working at it and working at it and working at it, and still, we're not even on 1 foot, let alone 2 feet. There are great stories in here that we don't have time to get to today. I particularly like the stuff you put in there about the outsourcing and Halliburton and other contractors and the private security forces. And also, on the lighter side, the huge number of men and the not-so-huge number of women, particularly inside the green zone. I wish we had time to get to those stories here today. I'll just direct people to the book. It's called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Congratulations on this, Rajiv.
Thank you, Paul, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. And congratulations to the people of St. Louis on that great baseball victory yesterday.
Thank you very much. We're looking forward to the World Series, and I'm looking forward to having you back sometime to talk more about Iraq.
Talk to you soon.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, the assistant managing editor of the Washington Post, author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.